S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shiba, shiba! Shiba, shiba! Shiba, shiba!
Let me in!
Shiba, shiba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shiba, shiba!
Open up your soul!
Shiba, shiba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew!
Let me touch your...
Touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. There's so much to be enjoyed. Today I get to talk to a fantastic actor, and this person is a mover and a shaker in the Bay Area. I'd like to welcome the incandescent Leontine Mbeliumbong. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on the show today. So you've got a brand new show that I don't even, it looks Greek and I want to say the Antipodes, but I could be wrong. So I'm going to let you say what the name of the show is.
It is the Antipodes.
Ooh, okay. Yes. So close. So
the other
close.
Side of the world. Yeah.
So what is
yeah,
it? What's an Antipodes?
Well, The Antipodes is the name of an Annie Baker play. It's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, and it is the first fully produced, fully staged play that the Actors Reading Collective is putting on, has put on. So it's a very exciting moment for us. Literally speaking, The Antipodes means the people on whose feet are exactly opposite you, so the other side of the world.
Okay, I have a lot of questions. So we're going to start with Actors Reading Collective. It sounds like it's brand new, so tell me all about that.
Yes. So during the pandemic, I don't know if anyone remembers that, when all the theaters shut down, we were all stuck in our homes, Jim Carpenter and Anthony Fusco got together and were like, hey, let's read a play. You know, we had nothing better to do. And so from there, it grew into a group of about, oh my goodness, I think there were over like 100 of us, who every Thursday would get together for Thursday at 7, reading a play from our homes, from our living rooms. And it just kept us going. It was, you know, we kind of called it coming to church. And we've read over 100 plays in this way, and it was just a wonderful place for us to gather and to remember who we are and to tell stories to each other. And then out of that, we discovered that how wonderful it was to just hear the words of plays. You know, so often you go to theater and there's so much stuff happening on stage and everything, but just to have us in our little Zoom boxes reading words was, we found, particularly effective and moving and exciting. And so we were like, we need to hold on to this. And so then we started doing readings, public readings on Zoom. And then from there, we moved outside the box and we've done two reading series in person, just reading plays. In person, and then moving on from there, our next step was into a full production that still maintains that same spirit of just storytelling and the basics of you know, actors doing their work and sharing that with audiences.
That's
that
amazing.
Intimacy and that simplicity.
It sort of harkens back when actors used to regularly do radio plays and people could just hear the word and use their imagination. And it really struck you how strong a piece of work was if it didn't need the visuals to make it compelling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, you know, like, there's a reason that playwrights have this, they have things to say and they have this medium. And so to really honor that with just the talent that we have in our company, and is just really exciting and an honor for us to be able to be able to do that and to be able to share that with folks.
So when you guys were you know, trying to keep sane by reading plays, how did you all decide which plays you were going to read?
Well, first it started off kind of simply, oh, I have this play, let's read it. Mm-hmm. And then, we became a little more organized and people, and we would send out, you know, a questionnaire and people would submit plays that they wanted to read and then mm-hmm. we'd vote on them and then we'd read them.
Okay.
And then to select the plays that we read for the public, it was kind of based on the ones that we had read amongst ourselves, and mm-hmm. then we voted on those and which ones we found most effective or that excited us most, and then and those were the ones that we shared.
And did you say how many plays you had read, or like it sounds like it would have been dozens and dozens.
Yeah, it was over 100.
Okay. And out of those hundreds, was the Antipodes part of that, or was that the
Antipodes was indeed one of the ones that
okay.
we read. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And what
that really just excited us in the room, and yep.
Okay, so the Antipodes is the person whose feet are on the other side of the world. So give us an overview of the plot for people who aren't familiar like me.
It is about a group of people who have been gathered in a room by a company mm-hmm. to figure out a story to tell.
Okay.
And it's really like think of your favorite TV show. I don't know, The Sopranos or any other.
Sure.
Of course, my mind goes blank as to TV shows, right? But like, or This Is Us or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And the first day in the reading room, okay, we have to come up with some theme or some like storyline, or how do we do there? How do those things get created?
Mm-hmm.
That every week it comes to you and it's like this amazing thing, and who thought this up, and who, and it's really the nexus of that, like the first day, starting from the first day of how do people sit in a room and come up with stories, sharing personal stories,
mm-hmm.
Just riffing and talking and looking into different things. And so it's this group of people who are coming up with this, but it also is set in the context of like the company is never determined or stated, or what exactly they're working for isn't, but you get this real sense of like what this room is like and the dynamics between mm-hmm. and the hierarchies and the interplay between the men in the room and the one woman in the room and the interplay between, right, like who's new and who isn't. And so all of those dynamics are explored, but never explicitly, right, like not in any explicit way. It's just watching these people work and come up with their ideas and share their personal experiences towards this end that we don't necessarily know, but it is really just watching the process. And it's fascinating because mm-hmm. Annie Baker writes in this supernaturalistic way.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you can kind of forget that you're, that, you know, you're watching a play because it's just these people experiencing and living and, mm-hmm. and sharing with each other. So it's a very intimate thing that kind of also makes you think about how the stories that you love are created and what it means and what it costs to people, and also how important it is, right? Like how important it is in your life to have stories.
Now you're wearing a number of different hats in this production, are you not?
I am. The biggest one is I'm on the steering committee of the Actors Reading Collective.
Okay.
And then I'm also the production manager and the stage manager.
That's three whole jobs. How is one person doing three entire jobs?
I'm not sure, but again, somehow it just happens.
You're like the Headleys, you know, him got 14 jobs. It's like, how do you do it? That's crazy. So does this mean you're not actually on stage performing this time around? You're behind?
That is correct. It is my privilege to like scurry around behind the scenes and set everyone's props and then sit in the booth and call the show.
Now, is that your first time in that capacity or have you done it before?
It is my second time. My first time was for Colored Girls at African American Shakes, directed by Elizabeth Carter. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And which do you find there's a certain freedom in not being on stage, or is this just, you're adding this to your repertoire of things you like to do?
There is a certain freedom. It's wonderful to be part of a production in a capacity that isn't like the one that is presented to the audience. But it's the thing about theater and about a lot of things that get produced, is how much work goes into it behind the scenes that no one ever sees, that no one will ever see. You know, the people dressed in black who scurry around are just as important as those on the stage who make this, that everybody sees and knows and recognizes.
Right.
It is the true beauty of theater as a collaborative art that there is this other part to it that is just as important. It's in this show, there's so much, there are a lot of props. So it's a really simple thing, but there are a lot of props that need to be set in specific places because, right, they need to come out at very specific points and really quickly and all of that. And so having that set and done properly and kept track of is a super important part because otherwise, they'll get on stage, they'll reach for something and it won't be there. And oh my God, now what do we do? So it's that I really love being part of that, that little unseen thing that just sets the stage just perfectly for them, for the actors to come in and do their work. It's a great honor. It's a great fun. And then you get to be in the room and watch the actors work and hear the director, our wonderful director, Alison Schacker, who came in from New York to direct this, watch her work and see it all develop and build. And then you get to sit in the booth and watch the final product, night after night and see how it changes and how they grow into it and how it all settles in. And so it's a great, bird's eye view of a production.
So in this production, who are the people who are inhabiting the roles?
So we have Robert Parsons, we have David Sanico, we have Timothy Roy Redmond, we have Samuel Ademola, Howard Swain, Liz Sklar, Rajiv Shah, and Harry Davis and Isabel. I'm drawing a blank on her name.
Think of a cow. It'll come to you.
It will come to me.
So while you're thinking about it coming to you, when does it open and where is it playing and how can we see it?
It has opened. We opened on the 8th, but we have two more weekends.
Oh,
and
sweet.
We'd love to have people come. We play this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then next week we're off for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Yay, everybody, Turkey Day. And then we have Friday, 2 on Saturday, and our closing performance on December 1st.
And where?
And it is at Marin Shakespeare Company's new indoor space. In San Rafael.
Okay.
On 4th Street in San Rafael. And information is available at our website at arcstream.org.
Okay. And how do people get tickets?
So you can go to our website and click on the home page and it'll take you to the page to get tickets.
Okay. Yes. Okay. And if people show up, can they buy tickets at the door?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Come on by. I know that nowadays, you don't know on Thursday what you're going to be doing Friday night.
Exactly.
And if Friday night, you're like, what I want to do is go see some folks tell me stories.
Yeah.
Then come on by.
Yeah. And I got to say, I really appreciate the role that you play because I was in a production, and you don't notice what people are doing until you don't have that person doing it. So if you don't have a stage mm-hmm. manager, nobody knows when to go out on stage. Nobody knows what's happening. If you don't have someone setting props, like, you're like, oh, where is it? So, all of those things that you don't think about because someone does them well is something you really miss if there's not someone there. So, yes, you're right about the behind-the-scenes people who keep mm-hmm. the show going. So I really appreciate yeah. that you're willing Absolutely. To step behind the scenes to keep it all, to keep it the roof from caving in. If people want to find out more about what you're doing, how would they go about doing that?
Me personally or the company?
You and the company. You can give me two things.
So definitely sign up for our mailing list. Again, at that website, arcstream.org. Sign up for our mailing list and we'll keep you posted on what we're doing, what was going on now and what will be going on in the future. For me personally, you can visit my website, which is Leontine and Billingbong, including the hyphen, .com. So I'll be back on stage in the new year. So it's been a nice switch up to be behind the scenes and then go back. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
And once more for our listening audience, the Antipodes, when and where?
The Antipodes running now through December 1st at Marin Shakespeare Company on 4th Street in San Rafael. Information available at ArcStream, that's ArcStream.org.
All right. Well, Leontine Mbele-Mbong, and I was just thinking today, just like, you know, I've said it a million times how much I love your last name, because it's like, it feels like when bubbles float by, you know, that feeling you get when you see bubbles. It's just such a pretty name. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us and for supporting. A lot of companies are closing right now, and so it's really exciting to be part of a company that is coming up. And so if your listeners are willing to support that, we would love to have them.
Excellent. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out the Antipodes. And I'm sure, knowing how fabulous Leontine is, because I've seen her and she's amazing, I can only imagine how great the rest of the cast is. So go check it out.
Ah, Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Burr.
Sir. And did you hear the news about good old General Mercer?
No.
You know Claremont Street?
Yeah.
They renamed it after him. The Mercer legacy is secure.
Sure.
And all he had to do was die.
Yeah, that's a lot less work.
We ought to give it a try. Now how you gonna get your debt plan through?
I guess I'm gonna finally have to listen to you.
Really?
Talk less. Smile more. Do whatever it takes to get my plan on the Congress floor.
Now Madison and Jefferson are merciless.
Well, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Hamilton.
I'm sorry, Burr, I gotta go.
But
decisions are happening over dinner.
Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room.
Diametrically opposed foes.
They emerge with a compromise, having opened doors that were
previously closed, bros.
The immigrant emerges with unprecedented financial power, a system he can shape however he wants. The Virginians emerge with the nation's capital. And here's the pièce de résistance. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.
Thomas claims
Alexander was on Washington's doorstep one day in distress and disarray.
Thomas claims
Alexander said,
I've nowhere else to turn,
and basically begged me to join the fray.
Thomas claims
I approached Madison and said, I know you hate him, but let's hear what he has to say.
Thomas claims
well, I arranged the meeting, I arranged the menu, the venue, the seating.
But no one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the parties get to yes. The pieces that are sacrificed in every game of chess. We just assume that it happens,
but no one else is in the room where it happens. Meanwhile, Addison is grappling with the fact that not every issue.
I love that song so much. It's Leslie Odom Jr., Lin-Manuel Miranda, and David Diggs, and The Room Where It Happens from the Hamilton original Broadway cast recording. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, you know, the French had a name for it. I think it's called sex, but it could be just any number of things. There's a gentleman who's been doing the French have a name for it for years and years and years, and it's got the French have a name for 24. I'm probably garbling everything, so instead of me flapping my gums, I'd like to welcome Donald Malcolm. Hello.
Hello, Marilyn. It's so great to be here. Unfortunately, I wish I could be with you in the studio, but I'm calling you from very sunny Southern California in Santa Barbara, wishing I could be with you in the studio because, you know, it's such a safe haven. It's such a wonderful spot with all that great music and the culture that you bring to people and the love. And, boy, goodness, you know, don't we need that right now given the way things are going in our country?
Oh, ooh. Yeah, you're right. Yes, we do.
So, absolutely. It's French 24 Part 2 because we were together about 6 or 7 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Talking about Part 1, which mm-hmm. I think we delved into the fact that that covered a lot of ground for our contention that French film noir was the first noir beginning in the 1930s, and we showed a number of films from that decade, including, I think you might recall, we talked about Les Miserables, which is a 1934 epic version of the tale, which I think the people who came and saw it recognized that it was definitely film noir mm-hmm. and proved our point. And we're back for 18 more films. We had to make a few adjustments to the schedule due to things that sometimes come up. So you remember that big program that we looked over when with you?
Yeah. That was an amazing program.
And that had to change a little bit, but I think it's a little bit better. And so I'm going to lean into it by asking you to remember a film, because I know you're an American film noir fan as well.
Mm-hmm.
You remember a film called Sunset Boulevard, correct?
Of course I do, yeah.
Of course you do. Everybody knows Sunset Boulevard, even if they don't know what film noir is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got that fabulous performance from Gloria Swanson, and of course William Holden dead mm-hmm. in the swimming pool, right?
Right.
But there's also another person in that film that I think people probably know at least from that film, but they may not know that much more about him. Do you know the name of the person I'm talking about?
Are you talking about Max? Was it the Max?
I'm talking about Max the Butler.
Yes,
right. That's Max, who you're thinking of.
Yeah.
And who is the man who played Max the Butler?
Is it Max von Stroheim?
Erich von Stroheim.
Good. Yeah.
You get to go into the next part of the quiz.
Thank you.
So Erich von Stroheim. It turns out that Erich von Stroheim ended up in France for most of the rest of his career. He was only back in Hollywood for a brief period of time in 1950 because he was called upon by Gloria Swanson and Billy Wilder to play Max the Butler. Because in his former career as a director, he had directed Gloria Swanson in a film of hers in the silent era. But his career blew up spectacularly, and he had to sort of go on the lam. And it turns out that the place that he went, you know, to have his own safe place was France.
Okay.
And in the late 30s, and then again after the war, he was in France, and he's in 20 French film noirs over that period of time.
Wow.
And we have shown, I think when we're finished with the series, with the four that we're going to show in part two, we'll have shown 8 of those films. So, but this is our most concentrated dose of von Stroheim, and we will begin our show on Black Friday, November 29th,
ooh,
with the double bill of Erich von Stroheim in two very, very different films, one of which is called The Dance of Death. That, mm-hmm. that gets you going right there, right
uh-huh.
with that title.
Okay.
It's part of a subgenre that we discovered that's part of the book, which I will talk about sometime later on in our conversation. That subgenre is what I call the flawed couple subgenre.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, is this ever a flawed couple that we see in The Dance of Death. It's actually originally from an August Strindberg play, but it was updated, and it was something that von Stroheim really wanted to do, and it is very dark. It's followed by a really fascinating film that's probably the first incarnation of a hybrid film. It's a hybrid noir and science fiction film called The World Will Shake.
Ooh.
And von Stroheim is not quite as prominent in this film, but he is part of a cynical group of people who want to take advantage of a very macabre invention, which is part of the science fiction part of the movie,
okay.
Which apparently whoever thought this story up decided that they could create, that there would be scientists who could create a machine that could tell you the exact day that you would die.
Oh.
And, of course, with a machine of that nature, there's going to be, you know, evil people, and we have many evil people in our present-day world that we are worried about, who want to take advantage of those things. And so that becomes the drama in that film. And so von Stroheim is one of a series of bad guys floating around in this film called The World Will Shake. And that's how we will shake things up on Black Friday in the Little Theater, which is primarily for our film club folks, because I think when we talked before, I think you know that the pandemic sort of took a little charge out of the audiences that came for us.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think of noir as of what we do as a niche within a niche, you know, and we can give a lot of kudos to Eddie Muller for making the niche of film noir so much more, you know, available and so more widespread to us with what he does on TCM and with his festivals around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a niche. It's still not something that's, you know, like absolutely mainstream. And we're on, you know, with what we've discovered with this area of French noir is a niche within a niche. And so we've been, you know, we've sort of been sort of treading water between the two. And when I decided to write the book, I figured that we should stop at a number of films that would not make my book so encyclopedia length, it would be impossible to bring it to the people. And so that's what we're doing. We're stopping with 155 films, and they will be in that book.
Wow.
What we do after the 29th is that we will have five more films on the 30th in the little room, and it will be, this will be the part of the program that deals with the male portion of film noir in France. The way I was able to orchestrate this is that the last eight films that will all appear in the big theater,
mm-hmm,
will all be much more geared around issues regarding women. And we can talk a little bit more about that as we get to the films. So on November 30th, we will be showing films that feature some of the hunkier actors that,
okay,
we have seen in French film noir, including our old friend Robert Hossein, who was a writer-director who is part of a very energetic final period of French noir that occurred from 1957 to 1966. He not only made his own movies and starred in some of those, he also starred in other films. And this film that we're showing called Le Meurtrier, the English title is called Enough Rope, he plays a police detective who is trying to connect the dots between two murders.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about this is that I did some background reading about this, and you remember Peter Falk on his great detective show,
mm-hmm,
Columbo,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Apparently, there are people who claim that Hossein's character in this film from 1963, Le Meurtrier, was really the basis for Lieutenant Columbo.
Oh.
And you can kind of see it in the way that Hossein goes about what he's doing to try to get these, you know, to connect these two murders and deal with these two bad guys. One of whom, by the way, is the actor Gert Frobe, who played Goldfinger in the James Bond film just a year after this film, Le Meurtrier, was made. And it's a lot of fun to watch Hossein put all of those people through his paces as he's able to, you know, get at them and try to connect the dots in the thing. We then follow with an Italian actor who we've seen in a couple of French films before, who is more famous for a film that was made, and I think Eddie showed this, and we showed it a few years before he did, mm-hmm, called Bitter Rice. And he was an ex-soccer player. His name is Raph Vallone, And he is in a very interesting French film called Le Piège, or mm-hmm. No Escape.
Okay.
Where he's a drifter who stumbles into a situation where he becomes involved romantically with a very attractive woman who is a widow, but she's still being stalked by her father-in-law, and it gets very complicated and uh-huh. very steamy. It's a very interesting film that one of our great supporters and co-workers, Phoebe Green, who has, I think, will be having her own series in the next year or so at the Roxy, doing some things that are French-related that are not noir.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who uncovered this one, and it, I think people really find it to be quite an amazing film.
Okay.
That's our matinee for November 30th. The evening show is devoted to another one of the discoveries of the festival, one of my favorite guys, because he kind of epitomizes noir in France and noir in general, an actor named Henri Vidal.
Mm-hmm.
And Vidal's claim to fame or infamy is that he was, aside from being a major hunk, he was a drug addict, and his life ended at the age of 40, which is a very noir way to go.
Okay.
From a heart attack induced by years of having a drug issue.
Okay.
But we get to show three of his films over that evening on November 30th, which give you a good range of what he could do.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, somewhat harrowingly, will show you the difference of what he looked like in 1950 in the film we'll show at number two in the lineup, Kate Grinnell, which is a film where he gets himself into just one terrible predicament after another,
mm-hmm.
Rather autobiographical, I get the impression. So you'll get a sense of what he looked like before the impact of the drugs, and then you'll see the last noir that he made in 1959, just a few months before he died,
mm-hmm.
called The Beast at Bay, where he goes on the lam with a wealthy widow who somehow decides that he's exactly what she wants,
mm-hmm.
and they go on a very interesting spree, played by an actress who's in another film we'll talk about a little bit later, an actress named Françoise Arnoul, whose physical attractiveness was so great that when her obituaries were written a few years ago, people were focused upon her physical attributes more than her acting ability, which is a real shame because she's a tremendous actress. And this is another one of her really fine performances playing opposite Vidal. And so that is what we have for our film club and for a select group of people that can get tickets for the limited space that's in that smaller room of the Roxy.
Okay.
So let me stop there for a second and let's talk a little bit about logistics about tickets. And also let me, you know, I had sent you something. I don't know whether you had a chance to find it. But as you know, I can go on for a long time. We should probably give people a kind of a succinct summary of what this is all about. And I wrote something up for it, and I don't know whether you were able to get your email, because I know you could read this better than I can read it. But if it wasn't something that came up and you don't have it handy, I'm ready to do it right now. So if that's not something that you were able to see before we got together, I'm ready to roll with it right now. So you let me know. Which way do you want to go?
Roll it.
Okay. This is what we have to say. The French had a name for it, 24 Part 2, brings a landmark 10-year series to a smashing conclusion with 18 more rare film noir from France, the actual birthplace of noir. 7 ultra rarities play in the Little Theater on November 29th and 30th, followed by 11 more gems in the Big Roxy from Sunday, December 1st, through Tuesday, December 3rd. Major film icons still well-known today, Jean Gabin, Jean Moreau, Brigitte Bardot, all make their appearances in terrific films you've never seen.
That captures it. So, like,
yeah, I think you know that. I think that's a good tag. I think, you know, if we, you know, we could get that up on a crawl, I think that would, you know, obviate the need for me to flap my gums. But you know, I love to do that, and I love to talk about these films. So here's the deal. There will be a few tickets that will be available for the screenings that we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And all festival passes are still, there's still a few of those available, and they will still be on sale until tomorrow night.
Okay.
On November 20th, the Roxy's site will come live, and single tickets for all six double features and two triple features. If you do the math, that's 6 times 2 is 12, and 2 times 3 is 6. Added together, that's 18 films.
Mm-hmm.
Those single tickets go on sale this Wednesday, the 20th, and people can, and hopefully we'll lap them up, and we look forward to seeing people, particularly for the films that we'll talk about next, the ones that are in the Big Roxy starting on Sunday, December 1st.
So you talk about the big theater and the Big Roxy and the Little Roxy. So I don't think I'm even familiar with the Little Roxy. I only know, like, you know, you go to the box
yes.
office and
well,
go in.
The Little Roxy has been the screening room and is tied in. You know, it's interesting when you go there during the day, you go through this screening room to get to the offices where all the great people that run the Roxy are ensconced behind the screen. We want to pay attention to them as opposed to the Wizard of Oz, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because they really make things happen there. And the Roxy schedule, has become so amazing in the wake of some of the other things that I think we talked a little bit about last time, about the loss of screens and the mm-hmm. loss of rep cinema
mm-hmm.
In San Francisco in particular. So it's ever more important that people, support the Roxy and go there and they are widening the things that they do. And, so the Little Roxy is up at 3125 16th Street. There's a bar between them and the big theater that everybody's accustomed to.
Okay.
And so the films on the 29th and 30th are designed for, the ones that I described are really on the leaning edge of really being the more obscure ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that we designed for the Big Roxy for December 1 through 3, feature Gabin and Moreau and Bardot, which I think is going to appeal to, a broader audience, of our niche within the niche that we were talking about earlier. So that's the situation. People will be directed, anybody that's buying tickets, for the Little Roxy will be directed by the people at the box office to, where to go. It's just a few steps away.
Okay.
And they've been running it that way. And so that was something that was very useful for us when we wanted to do even more specialized shows, which also involved the great assistance of my friend Phoebe Green when we showed non-noir French films for that niche within a niche within a niche. And we had a lot of fun with that, and I think that's what we'll continue with Phoebe doing it her way. It'll be the woman's touch, and I think that will be even better than what we were doing when she and I were working together, because she knows that portion of that lost world of French film
mm-hmm.
better than I do. And I've seen what she has in mind, and it will be terrific. But why don't we move on to December 1?
Okay.
And we'll talk a little bit about what we're going to be showing, because after we'll show a little bit more Eric von Stroheim to start off a big day of six possible films for people to come to.
Mm-hmm.
We'll open a little early at 11:30 with von Stroheim, who, by the way, he had a nickname when he started making movies in America because he played so many villains
mm-hmm.
because of his, he's not the handsomest man in the world, as you probably remember. he was a villain, and he was given the tagline, "The man you love to hate."
Yes, yes.
So in the first film that we show called The Alibi,
mm-hmm.
he is right in the pocket of that description. He is playing a ruthless con man who murders someone and then tries to get away with it. And, of course, the police are after him. And one of the real interesting benefits of this film for people who've been around watching some of our shows is that the police commissioner in this film is one of the great legendary stage actors who also had quite an interesting film career, named Louis Juvet.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Juvet might be familiar to you if you had a chance to see a film called Quai des Orfèvres, which Rialto Pictures put out a few years ago as part of the things that they do with French film noir, the part of French noir that I call the French noir canon that people tend to know. They know Jean-Pierre Melville. They know certain films by Henri-Georges Clouzot, of which Katie Orfèvre is one. You probably remember Diabolique, correct?
Yes, yes.
And you remember maybe watching The Wages of Fear. Those two films, those are Clouzot films. Those are films that Rialto brought to America as part of the things that they did for the American cinema public. Obviously, what we're doing is we're going into a much deeper reservoir of films that never made it over here that deal with what I like to call the lost continent of French film noir. And so Louis Jouvet was in that film that Eddie showed and that was shown around the country, mm-hmm. and he is tremendous playing the dogged police commissioner after von Stroheim and trying to bring him to justice. And so I think that's going to be a fun film for people to see. That is followed by yet another change of pace where we see the range of French noir being able to move itself into a boys' school mm-hmm. where all kinds of strange events go on with the secret society of young men who are dealing with a series of crazy events that include the murder of one of the teachers in the school, and one of the chief suspects of that particular crime is none other than Eric von Stroheim, who looks quite a bit different in this film because they decided to, instead of to give him that sort of chrome dome look that he tended to have, shaving mm-hmm. his head, mm-hmm. they gave him this incredible brush cut and a whole different look, which he plays upon in a way that shows that he really had a lot of acting chops, and it's just a very interesting film that I think is just a totally different experience. It's called Les Disparus de Saint-Agile, set in a boarding school, and it's kind of this combination of a boy's story and a film noir. It just kind of shows the range of what was already happening in French noir, even in the late 30s, before we really see the real kickstart of film noir in America just a few years later in the 40s with Le Maltese Falcon. Mm-hmm. And so that gets us started, and then we will show two more films by a director that we showcased in part one of French 24, named André Cayatte. And this is where we have that dividing line between men's films in film noir in France and mm-hmm. women's films in France in film noir. The first film of the Cayatte, this Cayatte showcase is called Two Are Guilty. The French name is La Glaive et la Balance. Mm-hmm. And it's a courtroom drama where there are three suspects in a murder and only two of them are actually guilty. And so what Cayatte is trying to do is to see whether the audience can figure out mm-hmm. who the innocent party is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so flashbacks dealing with these three characters, one of whom is played by Anthony Perkins. It's an international cast of young actors.
Okay.
And they are all shown leading up to the events that lead to this murder, and it's up to the audience and then of course up to the courts at the end of the trial to try to figure out who's guilty and who's innocent. It's quite an interesting kind of whodunit, and of course these three characters are not the best human beings
sure.
you've ever seen, because it is a noir,
right?
And so I think it'll be a real interesting experience for people.
And is Anthony Perkins speaking perfect French, or is he speaking French with an American accent, or is he speaking English?
He actually does quite a good job with his French accent. He's really good with that. Of course, everybody knows that these films are all subtitled for the American audience, just in case anybody's getting the heebie-jeebies about that. But no, it's a very interesting film. Cayatte is a very, very underseen director, and it's mm-hmm. been really, you know, I've sort of kept him in my hip pocket for a number of years because I wanted to try to concentrate my fire on showing some of his films
mm-hmm.
So people would get a better sense of what he's done. And people did respond very well to the five films that we showed in October. But let me move on to the film that I think is going to really be interesting to a lot of people. It's a film called Trap for Cinderella, Piège pour Cendrillon,
mm-hmm.
and it is a film that Cayatte found from a novel made by a man named Sébastien Japrisot, whose career really took off in 1965 when this film came out in conjunction with another film we've shown called The Sleeping Car Murders, which was the first film directed by Costa Gavras, who you probably remember from Z and Missing and many of films of that type that were later in his career.
Mm-hmm.
That was his first film, and Jacques Brissot is the source novelist for both these films. Our film is the story of a woman who survives a fire that was obviously done under nefarious purposes. What we don't know at the time the film starts is whether this is the woman who survived the film, survived the fire,
mm-hmm.
And she was the victim, the intended victim, or was she part of the plot to murder the other woman.
Mm.
And to add a kicker to it, when she comes out of, you know, the injuries that she has, she's got amnesia and doesn't know who she is.
Okay.
And so the rest of the film plays out as she tries to find out which of these characters she really is. It's quite a film, and it's an incredible showcase for an actress named Dani Carell, who most of her career was always thought of as eye candy, and she still is eye candy in this film because she plays very sexy and very dangerous women as this film plays out. But it shows the range of her acting, and it is an incredible, incredible film. And it begins a series of 8 consecutive films that are geared around the women, the plight of women, women's issues, things about women that don't often get seen. And it kind of shows that the French were on the case of that.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for us in America in 2024, it also points up that many of those issues that they were talking about in these films are still with us.
Sure.
And that we are really needing to work on and sort of push back against the things that we see happening in our country today. So I think it's kind of relevant to be able to see these films as they give us sort of that, you know, window back in time that these issues have been with us for so long and we really need to find a way to solve these problems. And I think some of these films really address that. And as I talk about some of the other ones, as we get up to the Bardot films,
mm-hmm.
on closing night, that I think is especially prominent in the way this worked out. And one of the things about the changes in the schedule that were required were very beneficial to being able to make this group of films appear back to back to back to back in the mm-hmm. way that they do,
okay.
to sort of keep that issue sort of prominent as we close out the festival.
Okay. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Don Malcolm about the French had a name for it, 24. There are 18 more movies left until the book comes out. So do you want to tell us more about the movies coming up and then the book?
Yeah, and then we'll go to the book.
Okay.
I want to keep on a roll and get
sure.
everybody set up in terms of what they're going to see in terms of the women's films that follow the one I just described, Trap for Cinderella.
Go ahead.
The evening shows are devoted to 2 films featuring Jean Moreau.
Mm-hmm.
And what's nice about the way this worked out is that Jean Moreau is known as a new wave icon. Her career really took off, and she became an international phenomenon, sort of in the advent of the new wave, and I'm sure people remember her in Jules and Jim. And I think another film that was well known of hers was with Antonioni in this, you know, in the early 60s. But what isn't generally known is that her career started in 1950 when she was just 21, and she appeared in many, many French noirs, a number of which we've shown in previous incarnations of The French Had a Name for It. And what's nice about this combination of films is that we have one film that we start with that is another film that Rialto was able to bring over in the late 90s called Bay of Angels, Le Bail des Anges. And in it, this is the only time you will see Jean Moreau as a platinum blonde. She is playing a compulsive gambler who gets into a romantic relationship in the casinos. And it's an incredibly wild ride, very swoony, a little bit different approach to noir done by a director who's better known for new wave type of films named Jacques Demy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a film that I remember seeing back in the day and loving. And it kind of disappeared. And so it was an opportunity for us to bring it back and sort of bridge this period between Moreau as a film noir kind of actress before she became famous with films like Elevator to the Gallows mm-hmm. and Jules and Jim, etc. And you know, and what she, you know, what happened, what she did before, and the film that follows that is a film we showed back in French had a name for it too back in 2015 called Back to the Wall, where she plays an unfaithful wife who unfortunately picked the wrong husband to be unfaithful with. and the film is a story of how he exacts his revenge upon her. And it's as I described it in one of the things I wrote about it, it's a gloriously mordant film about infidelity and, you know, the pitfalls of what happens when you have the wrong person that you do the wrong thing for. So she ends up being a highly sympathetic character in a film that really has, it's just quite something. I encourage people to see it because I remember that people really, really were fascinated by it and the tone of it mm-hmm. when we played it back in 2015. And that closes out a very big day at the movies for December 1. We follow that up on Monday night, December 2, with what is the obligatory Gabin night. Jean mm-hmm. Gabin will mm-hmm. have a triple feature that night, and it's all about Jean Gabin and women. And so there are three different incarnations of Gabin and his relationships with women. The first one is called Their Last Night. It's a low-key, slow-burning film about a romance that inadvertently reveals the fact that Gabin is leading a secret life. By day, he is a milquetoast librarian.
Mm-hmm.
By night, he is a criminal mastermind. And the woman played by a great actress named Madeline Robinson, who, by the way, is a major character in Trap for Cinderella, part of the nefarious goings-on in that film that we already talked about. Madeline Robinson falls in love with him and tries to help him escape. It's a very bittersweet film and very rare, I think people will really enjoy seeing a part of Gabin's career that happened just before he came back into favor with the French audience when he made that film that you might have seen called Touché par un Grisby, which is one of the films in the French noir canon that Rialto brought over and is, I think, one of the better-known films. That happened the year after this film. But it's really quite an interesting little film, and I think it's a great way to sort of build yourself in. And then you'll have to steel yourself for a much darker film that follows called The Truth About Our Marriage, or La Vérité sur Bébé Jange, which features another great actress from French films in the 40s named Danielle Derrière. And mm-hmm. the setup in that film is that she's fed up with him, so she poisons him. And
as
he's
one
in
does.
The hospital trying to recover from the poisoning, and he relives his life, and he suddenly realizes that he has been a total bad guy to his wife, and there were legitimate reasons why she wanted to do him in. And I won't reveal the rest of the story and how it turns out, but the flashbacks are very interesting, and Danielle Derrière, who is known mostly for playing comedies and being a very beautiful, sunny type of person, really does a wonderful job being, you know, showing all the range of her character as she goes from being a loving young bride to being somebody willing to kill her husband. It's quite a film.
Okay. So, Donald, we are almost out of time, and I know that you have, I know you want to go through every movie, but we only
right.
have like 2 minutes left, so I'm going to let you decide how
right.
you want to use those 2 minutes.
I will speed it up and tell you that we then finish with one more Gabin film is called People of No Importance. It's another bittersweet film that I think people will enjoy. We follow up on Tuesday with the two films by Clouzot that were the first two films we ever showed in the series. And let me just say that La Vérité is a film that shows things happening to women just because they're women, and it's an unacceptable kind of thing, and it's something that Clouzot is railing against in the film. Bardot, Brigitte Bardot in the film, it's an allegory of Bardot's sexuality, the nature of her being someone who was very notorious, and in the time frame, and Clouseau made this film in order to sort of deal with those issues.
All right.
And that is really a tremendous double bill, and I hope people will come out to see that. The first film is also terrific, a little different, but it also features another woman who is not being done right by the circumstances in the film.
Okay. Well, Donald, I would love to talk more, but we are completely out of time. So I want to thank you so much for being on the show and for putting on this production.
Well, thanks so much, Marilyn. Remind people that it's the 29th through the 3rd, and we hope to see as many people there as we can. And it's been a fantastic series to do. And I thank you so much for being able to help us bring it to the people.
Thank you. Thank you, Donald. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out The French Had a Name for It 24 at the Roxy. Go enjoy it. Mr. Ford is waiting. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.